Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
The stuff you wear is inappropriate for what you're planning on doing.
You don't know anything about me. I'm ready.
You're not. And none of the stuff that you're thinking means anything anyway.
Never kissed anyone before.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
What we do on this podcast, if you are not already familiar, is that Richard and I pick one TV show that is currently airing and we watch it sort of obsessively week by week, episode by episode, break it down. We are currently watching We Are Who We Are, the HBO miniseries from film auteur Luca Guadagnino. And we are here to discuss episode 4. Which doesn't have a fun episode title because none of them do. But this is the house party episode, the wedding episode, whatever you want to call it. But we will not be discussing any future episodes of the series, just this episode, episode 4, and what has come before it.
It's like reverse Much Ado About Nothing. Instead of guys coming home from war and getting married, the guy gets married and then goes off to war.
It's true. Oh, man, that just makes me want to watch Much Ado. Before Richard and I get into the episode itself, we want to read a couple emails that we got. We got some great emails from you guys this week. Stillwatchingpod@gmail.com is where you can find us. I've been like really delighted by the feedback of folks watching the show with us. Because I think as we mentioned, maybe a little anxiously at the top, like this isn't our usual kind of show that we cover. And I wasn't sure how many people would come along for the ride with us, but, a lot of people seem to be really enjoying, watching the show and discussing it with us, so that's gratifying. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, it's my perfect Italian that I keep trotting out. It's really what's doing it, I think.
I will just say we got a large number of emails all on one topic, which was people think we misinterpreted a line, and I think they're probably right, which is when I asked you, Richard, like, what do you make of Chloe Sevigny's character saying, like, my kind but not my type, or my type but not my kind. I forget what it was. And I thought it was about Hillary Clinton. We talked about how it was about Hillary Clinton. And everyone who emailed us is like, I'm pretty sure she was talking about her assistant, who she later, like, dances provocatively with. And I was like, oh of course.
But the assistant is a metaphor for Hillary Clinton, right?
Obviously. Yeah. Didn't you see his white pantsuit? So, Richard, do you want to take a crack at re-evaluating that line if we think it applies to her handsome puppy dog assistant?
The line is what? It's my type but not my type? Or what is it?
Let us see if someone kindly wrote it out for us. My type but not my kind.
Okay. Yeah. Like his qualities are appealing. And yet there are certain other realities that I guess would be a bridge or an obstacle to a relationship. Mm-hmm. Which I kind of like that way of thinking about it. Like, you know, I'm certainly like, I find myself drawn to people who don't fit my, I guess, sexual orientation or whatever. And it is a kind of crush, you know? So certainly those are my type of people. They're just not, I guess, my kind. I mean, is that what she means? Like, I don't know. Because when I say my kind of people, I guess I kind of mean my type of people. I don't know.
Yeah, I just don't know exactly how to distinguish type from kind in that context. Or maybe he's not her kind because he's a Democrat interested in hearing Hillary Clinton talk.
There you go.
But thinking about like how Jonathan, the cheerful himbo assistant who loves poetry.
Gay poetry.
Is her type, maybe. Does he remind us of the Alicia Braga character, like Maggie? I don't know that I see a one-to-one there, but, maybe she just likes, like, nice, kind, nurturing people, which both of those people seem to be.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, she's a nurse and takes care of people, and
he
takes care of her in a way, and seems to have a sensitive soul. So, but also, I mean, in some ways, that the line suggests maybe a kind of prison that she's found herself in, or maybe made for herself, which is like that. Those are type and kind. I mean, they should maybe agree most of the time, but
I know interesting. Well, and like we'll get into it in this episode with the party, but like there are some interesting questions of that going around with the kid group as well, of sort of like what is my type, what is my kind thing, especially as like in a setting where we're like swapping partners or whatever. And then another email we got which I thought was really interesting comes from John, and John writes in, thank you so much for the podcast. I'm getting a lot out of listening to your discussions, especially about the perspectives about the parents of the most recent episode. I find myself so caught up in the stories of the young people that I don't see all that's going on with the parents. And I'm also distracted over how much alcohol Frasier is consuming. It's true. Watching this episode gave me like a stomachache and a headache at the same time. Two thoughts about your recent discussions. One, in episode 2, I loved your calling out the way the show uses sound and ambient dialogue to build out the atmosphere, particularly the way we hear the soldiers talking about gang raping a woman while Harper sits and reads. I've noted something similar with visual cues in Luca's movies in ways that often situate issues of power and class, like the refugee camps on Lampedusa in the background of shots in a bigger splash, the way the camera lingers on an open freezer that Elio forgot to close and which the maid closes for him in Call Me By Your Name, all the shots of all the cooks making all the food in I Am Love. We get these quiet but not really subtle reminders that the characters in his works live lives of wealth and privilege. Those cues feel different in the series, similar in that they really mark American versus un-American, an inherent power dynamics you've talked about, the way Harper's house is decorated versus the way Fraser's house is decorated, etc., but different because the military dradness of the base does so much to mask class distinctions. I really love this observation from John. Richard, what do you think of it?
Well, yeah, and I think that tension of class and, you know, it certainly nationality for this show are everywhere in the series. You know, I think that in some ways it's what the series is about. Well, it's about a lot of things, but, you see another version of that in this episode where, the presence of Russian money is there, you know, which is another huge geopolitical thing that is dealt with in a, in an indirect kind of poetic way. But there's certainly a class element there. I mean, this person is, or whoever lives in this, you know, mini mansion or whatever, has a certain financial status above any of the kids who are kind of, you know, availing themselves of their house. I don't know. So I think it's interesting, and I like thinking about it also, I tying together all of the threads from his other movies. It certainly seems to be a fascination of his.
Yeah, I never observed that for myself in his other movies. I, of course, like, knew that his subjects were privileged subjects, but I hadn't noticed the way in which he sort of lampshades that idea with some of these camera shots. So anyway, I will be on the lookout for more of that background shading, nuance, world building, etc., that's going on.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
All right. So in this episode, I actually want to start at the end and we'll wind back to the beginning. But I want to start with a pair of songs that were used. And we've talked before about the soundtrack and the score of this series, but the episode ends with two sort of back-to-back, very explicitly tied to war songs. We've got Brittany sits down at the piano and she plays Soldier of Love, which is an older song that has been sort of famously covered by Pearl Jam, but is a much older song. And, you know, the lyrics are like, lay down your arms and love me peacefully. And it's just about like war and being a soldier and all that sort of stuff. And then what plays over the very end of the episode as, we see, you know, our young bridegroom going off to war, is Living with War, which is a Neil Young song. I think it's a cover. But it's like, the lyrics are like, I took a holy vow to never kill again, war in my heart, etc. And we've talked, you know, we've talked before about the way in which this show is not exactly casting a hugely positive light on military or American military in general, though not making it the explicit subject of the show. But once again, in an apparent Luca Guadagnino style, the sort of the background, the set decorating of it. Mm-hmm. I loved these musical choices. These are both songs I wasn't hugely familiar with. They seem more on the nose than his usual, you know, style in terms of what songs to pick, but like, what do you make of this back-to-back, you know, musical choice?
Well, yeah, I mean, they just underscore the, tragic juxtaposition that it turns out at the very end, the whole episode was working to set up, you know, and it also made me think about where these kids live and how they live and who they live under. And I think we tend to think, or the bigger American, you know, consciousness tends to think of kids growing up steeped in violence as being kids from the quote unquote inner cities, you know, where there's gang stuff or, you know, some other version of that in some, you know, American towns. And yet these kids are steeped in violence. It's just violence with authority. It's blessed by the government, you know. Right. But everything they're there for is essentially pointed at either killing as an act of defense, but very often when it concerns the American military as offense. And you know, I don't think that the kids are being... that's being directly communicated to them every day, but it's around them. And I think it's not surprising then that you see them. So, I mean, you know, I was not the goodiest of two shoes when I was a kid, but like, I certainly wasn't breaking into houses and making a terrible mess and, you know, all this stuff. And I cringed watching the episode, but,
oh, for sure.
But you think about it, you know, this is at least, this is a healthier expression of, you know, kind of id, or not, it may be not the right word, but a healthy expression of that energy that sometimes can be channeled into either state sanctioned violence or just sort of personal, stuff. And then to see all of this riot happening with these kids for the length, you know, almost the entire 50 minutes of the episode. And at the very end, watching this one guy leave the party and get funneled right into this you know, system of supposed order, but that has created so much chaos across the world for the past, you know, many decades. It's a really tragic ending, I think. Yes. And I think that it, you know, I like that the show, you know, made such a potent point after several episodes of kind of this dreamy, languid thing.
Yeah, there's a couple moments of frenzy. I think you said riot, and I like the word I wrote down was frenzy. And like the first is at the end of the paintball sequence when they just sort of, I mean, the paintball sequence in itself, this sort mm-hmm. of like kids playing at war moment, the fact that like, I think it's Danny who does it, like that they like just shoot Frasier well beyond, you know, past the point that they needed to and stuff like that. And we see the welts on his chest later and stuff like that. But like at the end of that paintball sequence, there's just like an absolute, you know, riot. And like once the paintballing is done and they're just like throwing their clothes at each other and stuff like that. And then there's another sequence in the party. There's this one dance break where, like, I swear to you, the direction must have been, like, frenzy. Go for it. Mm-hmm. Like, pick movements that just feel like a frenzy. And it is... I was informed by the various like reviews I read by our colleagues who had watched the screeners that HBO provided that there was a party episode, that there was an episode that was just like entirely a party essentially, which I guess is this episode. I was envisioning something different. I was envisioning our characters going into a larger house party mm-hmm. and sort of like the story following them through that. The fact that it's a smaller house party actually makes it feel more dangerous. There's just a sense of danger in this episode, a sense of like what's going to happen, how is this going to go terribly wrong. And actually, like, the party itself doesn't go terribly wrong in the way that it might have, but the real danger it is like waiting for us at the end of the episode, you know?
Yeah, I was thinking a lot about the Hurt Locker and that Sam Mendes movie Jarhead with Jake Gyllenhaal. Mm. Mm-hmm. Where there are these scenes of these soldiers, you know, in the case of Hurt Locker, they have such an incredibly, I mean, every job in the military and especially when you're deployed is stressful, but these guys are disarming, you know, explosives. And there's a scene where they're in a tent or somewhere, I forget, and they're just like punching each other and they're just kind of getting that stress out. And then in Jarhead, there are these scenes of the soldiers, and that whole movie is about these guys in the Gulf War, like waiting to like kill someone essentially and feeling this, you know, animalistic urge, I guess, that they have to then kind of expel upon each other, like in this tent, and they're drinking and carousing, and you know, the two kind of big party riot scenes in this episode feel like the same thing, and only one of these kids is actually about to go off and do the other thing,
right?
But these other kids are so aware of it all the time, you'd have to be. And I think just, you know, I hadn't, maybe naively, I hadn't really thought about it until this episode that like the kid who leaves, like he's probably what, 18, 19, you know, right, exactly. I mean, a lot of the people that are getting sent away to fight some shadowy something, are children, you know, and I think that's really starkly stated in this episode, even though, you know, there are some sort of stylistic extremes that I'm like, are there really any kids who are that just sort of brazen about sex and breaking into houses and whatnot? There probably are. But I think that all of that abundance serves a point. I also thought about the Gaspar Noé film Climax. Have you ever seen that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That is much more of a sort of relentless. It's not even really a party. It's kind of a descent into madness. But just this kind of relentless imbibing and drinking and drugging and all this stuff that like, and then leads to that weird bottomed out point at the end of the party, where the rest of the kids get to kind of deal with the hangover. And this other guy has to scrape himself off the floor, kiss his wife goodbye, essentially, and like march off to, you know, So it's just really setting a really, powerful, image of how kids, the stakes of their lives, even though they're all hanging out with each other, can be very different within a small group of friends.
Right. And that sort of like the fond last look that Craig gives as he walks out the door. And the fact that like of all the kids, you know, like we're getting more and more information about the personalities, you know what I mean? And like Danny has his anger issues and his religious conflicts. Sam has his like stress over what's happening with Harper and Fraser and stuff like that. But Craig of all the young men just seems the most like happy and loving and like, mm-hmm. you know, innocent, in a certain, like, you know, older and wiser, maybe by what, 6 months or whatever than like some of his compatriots, but like also just like the loveliest, like he wants, you know, and like so these songs at the end, these two songs at the end about like soldier of, you know, like you know, lay down your arms and love me peacefully, you know, like of all the people in this party, in this situation, in this episode, least seemingly suited for war, I feel like Craig is that person. Well, maybe Fraser, but like, you know, like Craig, this like loving, like joy seeking character, is the one going off to war. It's just like, and I think it's made all the more, the tension on that is made all the more clear by this anecdote that happens. I think it's about like a quarter to halfway through the episode when they're playing. It's not spin the bottle. It's like spin the truth or dare, spin the truth. I don't know, but it lands on Brittany and she tells a story about a soldier with PTSD who, you know, like, physically threatened his wife and all this sort of stuff like that.
And actually did like, hit her with a lamp or something, right?
And hit her with a lamp. Yeah. So like, you know, this husband who came back from war and, you know, couldn't process his trauma and took it out on his wife, and himself. And, dropping that on the day that Craig has married this one, however ill-advised this teenage marriage may be, dropping that as a specter of like a potential future is really chilling.
Yeah. And it makes you think about like a broader generational thing, you know, between millennials, Gen Z, the younger half of Americans, I guess, and people the world over, really. You know, that Anne Helen Peterson, the writer, coined that term, the burnout generation.
Yeah.
Where these kids, you know, they're having this party, but they're all kind of aware that they're on this conveyor belt into a very uncertain adulthood. And whether that's, you know, who knows why Craig joined the military, you know, a lot of young people join it for financial reasons, you know, and so he has to become part of this machine to kind of force himself into a secure enough version of adulthood. And who knows where these other kids are going to go. And watching them sort of revel in the moment, in the present tense, reflective in the title of the show, all the while this kind of, this new day, this dawning of a new era of their lives is creeping up on them. And it does literally for Craig at the end of the episode. And
yeah,
it's just, I don't know, it's sad. It's, you know, you know, this show is 2016. It's tough times, for a lot of people, and tougher ones are to come. You know,
it's interesting that did you mention Shakespeare? Oh, you mentioned Much Ado. Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned Shakespeare because I was thinking about, it as well in terms of like some of the, you know, the more like Midsummer Night's Dream is sort of the best expression of like, you know, kids wilding out in the forest, sort of bacchanalia kind of thing. But I was also, you know, obviously I don't think you can watch, well, I don't know. I thought a lot about Romeo and Juliet and specifically like the Baz Luhrmann Romeo plus Juliet, which I actually just watched last week again for the millionth time. And I think it has something to do with like Valentina's wedding dress, mm-hmm. and like the Hawaiian theme and stuff like that, and the pool, jumping into the pool in her wedding dress and stuff like that. It's just like, it felt like Baz Luhrmann Romeo and Juliet iconography, and it that film, which I've only grown to appreciate more, does such a good job of, and especially as you get older and watch it, like making Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes, their Romeo and Juliet, feel so young.
Yeah.
You know,
there's also, Guadagnino's countrymen, or from many centuries ago, Boccaccio and the Decameron, you know, about these young people who flee to the hills outside Florence to escape the plague. And in essence, these are what, that's what these kids are doing, if much more temporarily, you know, and the plague is a lot more diffuse, or, you know, it's going to become much more literal in a few years, but that sense of abandon, like, amid ruin, you know, and I think in and you got the title wrong, Joanna, it's William Shakespeare's Romeo plus Juliet.
thank you.
You know, all the neon and you know, a lot of that was filmed in Mexico City, and it just has this like kinetic sort of energy to it. And there's so much beauty in it. And yet there is also a certain grit.
Right.
And so it's people making do with what they have. And I think that that's why it's so interesting that they steal away into this house that, you know, one could extrapolate. A lot of Russian money has come from its ill-gotten gains, like a lot of American money. And so they are finding a sort of joyous moment within these very charged and threatening spaces.
Right. And you watch this marriage, you know, play out, and like, I think, you know, Sam is the one with the most vocal objection to what's happening to his brother. I do have questions. So like Craig, Craig is in the airborne division, about to be, you know, deployed. Is his family, like, what is his brother doing there? Like, is his family there? You know what I mean? Like, why would his brother also be there is a question I have. Like, is he the legal guardian of his brother? Do his parents also exist on this base? Like, what's, I have some questions that we may or may not get answers to.
But, yeah.
That hadn't occurred to me until, this episode, where I'm like, why is his brother there? But, you know, the wedding of Craig and Valentina, you know, feels as ill-advised as any sort of I'm shipping out tomorrow, we're teenagers wedding might seem. But also it's just sort of like, it feels, I feel like, what's the harm? Like, all right, yeah. So they did this, and like, maybe they'll get divorced, or like, well, you know, the second he comes back, maybe she will, you know, regret her decision and want out of the marriage or whatever. But it's just sort of like, I don't know, weddings can be undone. It's okay. It felt like this is, I felt like enormously like supportive of whatever Craig felt like he wanted to do to make this terrible thing that he's about to do not feel as terrible, you know?
Yeah, and she seemed to understand that too in agreeing to do it, you know?
Yeah.
It was, there was a casualness when they're trying on the dress, and you're like, you know, oh, your parents are going to ground you for 2 years just so you won't cheat on them, and they all laugh, and it's like, yeah, she's probably going to cheat on them. It's 2 years, and she's like very young, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that it's more just like, you know, they're playing it a little bit of, you know, being grown-ups. The irony being that, like, he's about to go do a very, you know, supposedly grown-up thing. You know, so it's that weird space where, like, old enough to be in the military, not old enough to buy a drink legally, you know, the way that we kind of that the military treats, young people very much like adults in certain cases, while the rest of the world or their country doesn't, you know, that contradiction is certainly, there.
I want to talk about this question of Frasier, who, you know, was our, like, I don't know if this episode belongs to anyone, like maybe Craig most of all. But, you know, since Frasier was our entree into this world, I still often think of him as our main character, whether or not that's accurate. And it's funny, I've been hearing from some folks watching and listening to this podcast that they're having a lot of issues with Frasier, which I don't you know, that's not a mystery to me as to why he's a challenging character, especially when we see him interact with his mom, Sarah. But in this episode, what struck me as, like, you know, it's clear that he's not been like fully welcomed into this group by the way that the other boys like pelt him, you know, mercilessly. But he's also just like, he's in a couple instances of like being a giver or nurturer in this episode. Mm-hmm. Like when the moment on the bus where like he hands Danny the chips and Danny just takes them, and Danny seems sort of like, I don't know, kind of surprised and I don't know, grateful. It's this tiny, tiny gesture, but it's like, it's a measure of warmth from Fraser towards Danny that Danny certainly hasn't earned by any of his behavior towards Fraser that we've observed, right?
Yeah.
And then when he comes in and takes care of Sam, like brings the tea for Sam. And then when he like kind of helps wrestle up dinner, not really, but he like finds the spaghetti and then demands that the Italians get in the kitchen and make it, or like finds the music or whatever it is, you know, like he's not in like a needy way, but just sort of like in an, this just seems like his natural mode is to sort of caregive, in the way that we've seen, not his military mom, but his nurse mom do, you know? And mm-hmm. So I don't know, do you like, how intentional do you think that is? Like what was your takeaway from that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I can certainly relate to, you know, if you're feeling uncomfortable within like a new group of friends, or you're trying to either,
right,
you know, half-heartedly or wholeheartedly trying to break into that friend group. Like I certainly, when I was younger, maybe still am, the person who like tries to be helpful and yeah, provide. Same. And, you know, he brings the champagne, he finds the music, he brings that like potted fake flower out to when they're eating spaghetti, you know.
Oh, right.
Like yeah, he's like contributing in a way, which yeah, is a way to be seen. You know, I think about like
yeah,
when I was really trying to get into like the theater group in college, and like I was like, I volunteered to like assistant stage manage these shows and it was like real drudge work and, you know, whatever, but like it meant that I was there and I was doing something and I was seen and counted, you know. And I think it's sweet, and it is obviously really contrasted by the way we see him in other scenes, in other episodes, where that he's not sweet at all. So it just further kind of conflicts in an interesting way the portrait of Fraser that we're getting, as does the stuff with whatever is happening sexuality wise with him, you know, where he has this girl, I didn't pick up her name,
Sola,
who's really throwing herself at him almost as a kind of like, maybe she's trying to tease out something from him. Like maybe she's trying yeah, to get him to say I'm gay or whatever. And he seems, you know, unsure what to do there. He kind of kisses her back in one scene because maybe he feels like he should, or he doesn't want to disappoint her or something. And then you have Caitlin slash Harper, who is very protective of him, in a way that's
confusing.
Yeah. It's
going on there.
It feels, it's nice when she kind of, when they're all dancing and the girl is kind of getting up in his face and she just kind of gently takes him away. And yeah, then that later when he tells her, oh, I kissed her back, and Kate slash Harper is like, don't ever do that again. And you're like, where is right, that coming from?
Right. Yeah. No, it's interesting because, I almost, in last week's episode, they were like, let's never kiss, right? Let's agree to never kiss.
Yeah.
And that sort of seemed to feed into what you and I had been asking, which is like, is this going to be a romance, or is this going to be just like great pals seeing each other and supporting each other? But I think Harper is trying to do something else, which is almost use Fraser as a beard, would be my interpretation mm-hmm, of what's happening in this episode. Most especially in the scene, in the wedding scene, when Sam, who is freshly, you know, the ex, is looking over, and Harper reaches out and grabs Fraser's hand, and Fraser seems confused by it. And that just seems to, you know, and Brittany says something like, since you started dating T-shirt and is not contradicted. And so I think, you know, like Harper's using Fraser to a certain degree, not in like a malicious way, but just in like a safe harbor of like, I don't have to explain myself or fully deal with this thing that I'm still trying to figure out. People will leave me alone if they think I'm dating this person, however improbable this person may seem. Does that seem fair?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's unfortunately, there is oftentimes collateral damage of a sort when people are figuring out themselves, you know, and people use other people as protection or
right,
as, you know, something else. But yeah. And I also, you know, speaking about Harper's like, developing or at least developing in the show her identity stuff, like the paintball scene where she doesn't, you know, it's Craig, right, who doesn't shoot her, and then later they're asking at the party and she's like, is it because I'm a girl? And
right,
that is such a clearly such a loaded, frustrated question coming from Harper. that of course Craig in his kind of bleary state doesn't really recognize, and maybe wouldn't have went sober either. But we do. And that, right, that line definitely feels laden with a lot.
Absolutely. And also, I actually forget who is the one who said it to her. I think it's Craig, said something about, like, beautiful hair. You have beautiful hair. And that's just, you know, something that, like, Harper has a lot of hair. And, like, when it comes to, like, there might be some androgyny to, like, they're wearing, like, a large basketball jersey and stuff like that before everyone is, like, in their underwear. They're wearing, like, a large basketball jersey and stuff like that. But, like, the hair is, like, so long and so voluminous. I don't know if it's going to survive the series. We'll find out. But, yeah. And also the question of the naming, which you and I have been sort of going back and forth on, and gendering and stuff like that. It's I don't want to overblow the challenge. It's not like hard or whatever to like, I want to gender someone accurately. The question is like, how do you gender, or how do you name someone who is unsure of themselves? And it was interesting because like, one of our listeners pointed out that there was like something wrong in our podcast description on the podcast app. And I was like, I didn't see it right away. And I was like, oh, is it because the name Caitlin is used in the description? Is that what they were talking about? It wasn't. And our producer, Dave, who's the one who did the description, he was like, oh, I just grabbed that from the HBO description. So the HBO is calling his character Caitlin. Mm-hmm. Frasier, even in this episode, calls the character Caitlin, which is not what he's been calling them. And so I didn't know if that was like supposed to mean something, like that he was so drunk at that point that he wasn't being like conscientious with what he was calling this person or not. But I you know, that question of like, is it because I'm a girl? You know, I don't know. It's complicated, which I like. I love that the show is complicated. So, you know.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, this episode, there are aspects of it that I think are hard to love, because the party seems a bit alienatingly, like, intense. But
you've never had sex on a couch in front of, like, five of your friends?
While someone tinkers on a piano and someone else is naked walking around asking for underwear. Yeah, that's never happened to me, unfortunately.
Not relatable.
Okay, yeah. All right. And I've been to Fire Island a lot, Joanna. So, and that still hasn't happened to me. But yeah, but you know, even you know, my sort of like, you know, clutching my pearls. There's such a nice in terms of the way that the filmmaking, like it's such a natural flowing kind of episode. Really, I think, is the show hitting its stylistic stride. I love the music choices, the two you mentioned, the sort of the more orchestral piece at the beginning when they're having the slow motion paint slash hose fight. And then the way it all builds and the kind of wave breaks at that, and that, those lovely two closing scenes. You know, it's nice for the show to, and not to be corny, but to be asserting that it is what it is, you know, and kind of, I think, announcing some of its themes a bit more plainly, but still, you know, doing so in a really interesting, artistic, not typical TV fashion.
Yeah. No, and it's interesting because, like, that danger that I was worried about, I mean, the danger's there. The danger's there with the fact that, you know, Craig is about to be deployed. But the danger I was worried about in terms of the party, that's a different show. That's maybe Euphoria. That's maybe something else. That's a different movie. That's something else. But like, that we're trained to be worried about kids out of control drinking, out of control partying, you know, hypersexualized situation, whatever, like we're trained to be ready for something to go terribly, terribly wrong, almost as like a moral judgment. Mm-hmm. You know, you and I both, I think, are more goody two shoes than these kids. So you and I both were gently, if not clutching, then at least like grabbing at our pearls occasionally or whatever. But like, but what's interesting is that this episode's like, no, that's not the danger. These kids, these dumb kids, drinking to the point of vomiting or having sex or getting married or all their foolish shenanigans. That's not the thing that you should, you know, when we talk about, so I don't know if this is too much of like a wild stretch, but like we talk about American American moral values when we talk about, like, I don't know, film and TV ratings and stuff like that. And what's often true is that sex is more frowned upon than violence. And so this idea of, like, this, yes, this episode starts with, like, quasi-violence among the kids with this paintball excursion, but, like, the idea of like the pleasures, a revel, a bacchanal or whatever, drinking and shoving pasta into your hands with your fingers and having sex and whatever, that's not the danger. The literal actual war is the danger, and that I think is the point of that juxtaposition.
Right, exactly. And in that, you know, moral heads are turned in one direction when a real atrocity has been happening for a long time, you know, on that same supposed moral watch. And the show is definitely keen to that. In a way that I appreciate, it's not bonking us over the head with it. It could have easily done that. I mean, the danger that I was concerned about is that it was like a Russian mobster's house, and you know, but again, that's a different show. Thankfully. But, you know, I think, you know, but the going back to the Russian house thing, I mean, these kids are playing on a little corner of the stage of geopolitics. You know, they are they are caught up in this the same as anyone else, in a different, you know, different fashion, because they're not, most of them aren't actually soldiers, but they are living a soldier's life to some extent. They are, I mean, as we all are to some extent, like caught in that whirlpool, in that system. And zooming in and watching as individuals within that system stretch the boundaries of their lives and try to find themselves and explore with each other and with their surroundings, is happy, you know, even though that threat of danger was always there. But the show was not going to let us feel like that these kids were just, you know, living this unbridled sort of life for too long, because they're not in reality.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, in a different show, like, one of the kids would have cracked their head open in that swimming pool, or, like, you know, OD'd on drugs or something like that. And I just, like, I appreciate that certainly with a bigger splash. It's a similar thing with a bigger splash, right? Because there's just, like, there's a party, there's, like, a debauched sort of party situation going on, and then there's murder. But the party is not the danger, but then the party feels dangerous because we're living in a sort of environment of death and murder. And that's just interesting.
Yeah. And there's a surprising death in I Am Love as well. It just happens in a moment of different passion, you know, and then this terrible thing happens. Go ahead.
Well, I do want to circle back to Frasier for a second and the this thing that we both relate to, which is this, like, how can I be helpful? How can I give? How can I, you know, be seen in doing that? What I find interesting about Frasier is that he has, I don't know if it's obliviousness or confidence, but he has more confidence than I do. Because, like, if Danny had yelled at me, I would not have been confident enough to hand him a bag of chips. I would have just tried to make myself invisible.
I would have politely declined the chips so I didn't have to deal with the chips.
Exactly, right? Or, like, you know, Sam is in the bathroom and needs to puke. I would not, like, I don't know, brew him Lipton's. I don't know what that was that made him puke. But, you know, I would not go in and help the person who, like, clearly hates my guts and stuff.
And hold his, like, little lock necklace while he's puking.
Yeah. So, you know.
But there was also a bit of, I think, slightly sexual tenderness there coming from Frasier. You know, he was.
The way he was touching
his body.
His, like, arm.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, yeah. I don't think that was, like, fully altruistic, maybe.
Fair. I think that's fair. But yeah, I liked the premise of this. I liked them going to this store, pooling their money, you know, buying this little dress, buying a blazer, wearing dumb plastic lays, and, like, going to a wedding. Like, I was never, like, bold or brash or cool enough to do something like that as a team, but I just, like, I love this for them. I love that they did it. So,
well, they're, like, you know, giving themselves an occasion. They're seizing their lives are so governed by, like, the orders from on high, and, you know, they have very little agency in their lives.
Right.
And this is something they could do. It meant maybe accelerating one of like a romantic narrative a little bit faster than it should have been. But like it was right. something, you know, and when we get older, we always, it feels like, need an excuse to have a party, a wedding or a, you know, whatever.
Right.
You know, a lot of times kids just kind of do it to do it. But even this, like, they're like, well, I think partly they were so excited about the wedding was because it meant they could like really had an excuse to drink and carry on, you know, like they were giving themselves that gift to each other, which I think is sweet.
Yeah, I loved it. So let's talk about the final moment of the episode, which is Sarah seeing the soldiers off.
Soldiers who Richard had said weren't ready. And she right. was just like, well, you know, we got to send them. Like, nothing we can do. Like, people aren't ready all the time. Which
right,
is further
right,
kind of compounding this, like, tragedy of Craig. Such of a young Craig. Person.
I'm worried.
Yeah.
But yeah, and what she says is I think, because the sound mix was hard for me to hear, I rewound it a couple times, make America and yourself proud, uh-huh. airborne.
Yeah.
Is what I heard. And,
which is a lot to put on people.
Yes.
Like, you should be personally proud of what you do, but obviously the whole nation comes first, and it's like, Jesus Christ. Right. Like,
and also calling them airborne. I mean, I don't know if that's just like standard or whatever, but like it's so impersonal. Even more impersonal to me than like soldier would be.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even like soldier, you a person. It's like airborne, your like classification. That I just, yeah, it was, and it was such just like a, and like when he leaves, I mean, not to make it too Romeo and Juliet again, because what I do like about this is like, it's not the episode's not trying to sell me Craig and Valentina as like a beautiful love story, no. endgame or anything like that. But his last look that he gives as he's putting his shirt on and you hear the bird song, and it's very like, it, you know, it was the lark sort of Romeo saying goodbye to Juliet on his way to the grave, after their wedding night. And then to juxtapose that with just like the cold, chilly morning and everyone, you know, neatly in a row. I think it's beautiful and really, really tragic, you know?
Yeah. And he, the whole time when he's kind of surveying the wreckage of the party, but that has a peacefulness to it too. He looks so wistful, you know, exactly. because he's like, regardless of what happens to him in his deployment, that was in essence the last night of his childhood.
Yeah,
you know, he was already in the military, yeah. so like one could argue it was already over, but this really feels like a kind of almost ghostly goodbye, you know,
yeah.
hovering over everyone sleeping and disappearing with the dawn, you know, like, I mean, it's pretty poignant, I think.
Right. And if he's, you know, fingers crossed that Craig comes back, you know, safely, his body as safely as can be, but like, that Craig's not coming back from
nope,
whatever it is
no.
they're about to do that they're ill prepared for. So, yeah, I've loved this episode. I mean, it was stressful to watch at times, mostly because it just made me feel like throwing up in certain moments. The kids were really good at just looking like really, really obscenely drunk and on the verge of vomiting most of the time. And that can be tough to watch, but I think ultimately, it's a really beautiful story that he's weaving around this character of Craig, who, you know, has been fairly peripheral thus far. So, yeah. All right. Anything else you want to say before we find out what happens, on the base next week?
No, I think that's it. Good episode. Well done, everybody.
Yeah, well done. All right, until we return, where will you be, Richard?
I got a flight to Venice because I have a house to clean. Because that was stressing me out, let me tell you. And then I'll also be...
It was,
you know, go ahead.
It was the pasta sauce on the wall.
Oh, exactly. Because like, but beer bottles you can pick up. Ashtrays you can empty. The sauce on the wall in that white kitchen, that could be a problem. But I'm also tweeting at Rylaws as ever and writing at vf.com. Joanna, until we head back to Italy next week, where will you be?
Oh yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can find me on vanityfair.com. But mostly, you can find me handing out discounts on wedding blazers to random teenagers at the Army surplus store or whatever.
It's a good business model. They'll be back. There'll be another wedding.
Another wedding next week.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There is 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.